Welcome to the Shortwave Listener's Digest, Season 1, Episode 2, 2025. In this episode, we continue our journey with Ian McFarland, and we speak to our special guest, Larry Magne, of Passport to World Band Radio. Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to part two of SWL Digest 2025. I'm Colin Newell.
And I'm Ian McFarland.
Your program, the Shortwave Listener's Digest, was broadcast to all of Radio Canada International's target areas and could be heard in pretty well all parts of the world.
That's quite true. As a program producer, I was most fortunate to have a free rein when it came to choosing which of RCI's transmissions to schedule a program on. And I don't know that a program producer in any other major shortwave broadcaster, especially in Europe, would be able to do that. I had a very close relationship with the RCI engineering department, and I was well aware that the back of the antenna beam going to one target area, say Africa, would give very good reception in another part of the world. So I took full advantage of that, putting the program on the transmissions that would give me the widest possible coverage. One of the transmissions to the US gave very good reception in Australia and New Zealand, just as an example.
Wow. In addition to the regular items like Glenn Hauser's DX News on the Digest, you also had some very popular multi-part features. For instance, The Evolution of the Transistor by John Black, the Foreign Language Recognition Course, and the IDENTS and Interval Signal Series. What was the genesis of the IDENTS series and the language course?
Well, I figured that since most SWLs weren't multilingual, if they could at least identify the language that they were listening to at a given time using a reference like the World Radio TV Handbook or Larry Magne's publication, Passport to World Band Radio, they could easily identify the station they were listening to. So I got the well-known shortwave listener and language expert, Dr. Richard Wood, to discuss the various families of languages, and then there were spoken examples of all of those languages so that people knew what they sounded like. The same sort of rationale was behind the IDENTS and Interval Signal series. It gave the listener a chance to identify a station by its IDENT or interval signal or tune.
And some of the features in the program had something of a second life, didn't they?
They sure did. While the program was still on the air, some of the features were put on cassettes and sold to shortwave listeners as a fundraiser for the Handicapped Aid Program, or HAP for short, to try and introduce shortwave listening to the disabled.
Speaking of the Handicapped Aid Program, there was a major event in the shortwave hobby in 1973 I remember all too well. At the suggestion of an SWL, shortwave listener in Greece by the name of Nikos Dendrinos, 1973 was declared World DX Friendship Year. Many shortwave broadcasters, at least the ones which had a DX program, had special features on their program to mark this special year.
Well, many shortwave listeners will be aware of the reason why 1973 was chosen as a special year in the radio hobby. In the amateur radio world, the number 73 is the symbol that's used when radio hams sign off a contact with another operator. 73 means kind regards.
Yes, it does. In 1973, you also marked World DX Friendship Year in a somewhat spectacular way, technically speaking.
Yes, I did. With the help of a number of submarine cables, with yours truly as the hub in Montreal, I linked up Reg Kennedy and Henry Hatch, hosts of the BBC World Radio Club in London, England, and Arne Skog, host of Sweden Calling DXers in Stockholm, Harry van Helder, host of Radio Netherlands DX program in Hilversum, and Arthur Cushion of Radio New Zealand's DX program, and he was in Invercargill, New Zealand. The whole event came off with only one rather disconcerting exception.
And those names were considered the who's who in 1973. So with all those connections, you did very well to have only one technical glitch. What happened?
Well, the problem was something called an echo suppressor, which is supposed to prevent my voice from coming back to me, along with the voice of the person I was talking with. Either that bit of kit wasn't working very well, or someone forgot to switch it into the circuit in the first place. Luckily, it only affected the line between me and Arthur Cushion in New Zealand. And it takes a fair bit of concentration, I can assure you, to ignore your own voice coming back at you, along with somebody else's voice. And there is a time lag in there.
Moving from 1973 to 1991, what most radio enthusiasts would consider the absolute heyday of Radio International Radio Broadcasting, and long after the SWL Digest went off the air, you and I collaborated to give some of the most popular features from the program a second life through some of up-to-date technology, namely CDs and MP3 downloads.
Yeah, I burned a lot of CDs on my computer, I can tell you, and I mailed them out to shortwave listeners in many parts of the world. And you took care of the digital downloads and the masters for the CDs. And this, again, was a fundraiser, but this time it was for the food bank where I live in Vancouver Island in British Columbia.
You have a lot of fond memories about that, making a difference on the island, and I think over a period of about a decade, I think we raised about $17,000 for that food bank. And still in 1991 again, this brings us to the second big move in your life, bigger than moving to England and at least twice as far and a quarter century later.
Oh, yes, a 14-hour plane ride across the Pacific to Tokyo and Radio Japan. And that move happened 3 days after the decimation of RCI on Friday, March the 25th. A day that I remember as Black Friday. I'm sure longtime listeners to RCI will remember that day. We knew that the news was coming, and I and the rest of the RCI staff figured that the changes would take place at the end of March, which was going to be the end of the fiscal year. We only found out at the end of that day that changes were going into effect immediately, that very weekend. I had prepared 2 weekends' worth of my programs, and I would be saying goodbye to my listeners on the last weekend in March. So I had to quickly record a new closing to all my programs, explaining the changes and saying goodbye to my listeners. Earlier in 1991, NHK, that's Radio Japan's parent, had asked RCI to supply someone to be an English specialist at Radio Japan's English service in Tokyo. And this posting was put on the notice boards at RCI. And I had seen the postings, but I was hemming and hawing about applying. And one day I met our program director in the hall, and he asked me if I had applied for the posting. And I said that no, I hadn't. And he said, "Apply for it." So I did. I made the shortlist and ended up getting the job. So on March 28th, 3 days after the disaster at RCI, I was on a plane to Tokyo, and on April 1st, I was the co-presenter of the new flagship 15-minute live news program called NewsRound. And I suffered terribly from jet lag for 2 weeks after I arrived in Tokyo, so on the air I was running on fumes for a while.
Before we hear about the various aspects of your stint at Radio Japan, we have with us our final guest. He's the author of many shortwave receiver reviews that were featured on your program for a number of years. He was also the editor and publisher of the very popular shortwave publication, Passport to World Band Radio. On the line from the Keystone State, Pennsylvania, is Lawrence Magnay, no stranger to international broadcasting and best known for the most of us as the publisher of Passport to World Band Radio. Passport to World Band Radio, of which I have the entire library, in part to Ian McFarland, who's with us here today. Lawrence, good morning and good afternoon from the west coast of Canada.
Well, hello indeed. I'm glad to be talking to lovely Victoria Island.
Actually, technically we're on Vancouver Island, but it's meant to confuse any potential attackers if they're sent to Vancouver Island. They could end up in Victoria, Australia, perhaps different. So earlier preamble, Lawrence, we talked about your history in the realm of shortwave, and I always thought of you as the guy that put out all those wonderful books. And of course, I'm completely wrong. Your role has been more complex and diverse, and we want to talk a little bit about that today. So in contrast to what the shortwave world was in the late 70s and 80s, shortwave broadcasting encompassed domestic aspects, regional aspects, international aspects. And for a lot of us radio hounds, a lot of the elemental nature of that kind of broadcasting is gone, reducing domestic broadcasting now to just international broadcasting. So in the year 2025, Larry, can you tell me about where international broadcasting is right now?
Well, I think you summed it up very well. And Bob mentioned the Germans, who were famous for having shortwave on the 49-meter band going way back to the 1930s. And some of their cars, like the old Mercedes, used to have that shortwave 49-meter band on there just for those domestic broadcasts. But basically, domestic broadcasting on shortwave has gone the way of the dodo. And people do, you know, they pick up their domestic stuff from the internet, cell phone, satellite, and there's tons and tons of FM and most countries still medium wave AM. So they don't really need it. It doesn't serve a purpose anymore. If Ian were going from the, as he mentioned, the DX digest to the SWL digest, today he'd probably go to the International Broadcasting Digest, because that's really where it's at. And there are several kinds of international broadcasting. There's the official, like the Voice of America. There's the quasi-official, like RCI, BBC. There are the non-official, which are fairly scarce, but they still exist. They're religious mostly. There's the exile stations, like the extant Radio Free Europe. And then there's clandestine stations, which tend to pop up during times of military conflict. Some of these are white, which are what they say they are. And some of them are black, which are false flag operations, pretending to be what they're not. But there has been a major generational shift. It's caused a lot of this. So-called GI generation, the ones that fought in World War II, that generation in this country, the United States, was in power all the way through the first President Bush. And they worshipped at the altar of shortwave broadcasting, because firsthand they had seen this during the war. During the Cold War, which was very ideological, the shortwave broadcast assumed a whole new role, because the battles were no longer with bullets, except to some extent. They were largely in battles for people's minds, all that, and that meant shortwave assumed huge proportion during the Cold War years. But when, in this country in any event, George Bush Sr. left office, and in Europe and other Western countries, the same thing with those leaders, when it went to the what's called boomer generation, the post, those people born after World War II, they had no clue as to what shortwave was. I had a long conversation with the press secretary when the Clinton administration first came in. And we had a wonderful chat for about an hour, but it took maybe 60 seconds to tell me what I needed to know, which was that they thought of radio as FM with music and entertainment, and that was it. Shortwave was like something from Mars. And that was the end of that. And even in Switzerland, Bob may recall that they got a new director, and he was miffed at shortwave, because he's an opera buff. And he said that shortwave wasn't producing a good enough sound for his beloved opera. So the whole appreciation of international broadcasting and shortwave went down the toilet. And to replace it, they went in with FM rebroadcasting, which was familiar to the new leaders, and also, of course, the internet. And the problem with that is both can be regulated by the target countries. So people are usually listening to foreign countries, not so much because they want to hear different accents or news from, say, Texas. They're listening because they want truth that they're not getting in their own country, or at least a different point of view. And you can't do that if you're broadcasting within the country that's a target country, because the authorities will close you down. So what to do? They have closed down most mature way. And so when the Russia-Ukraine situation was evolving, the Russian government shut down the rebroadcast naturally and gave a major propaganda effort on all throughout its media, whipping up nationalism and making Ukrainians look rather foolish. And there was no alternative point of view. So what to do? They turned on the one remaining shortwave transmitter in the United Kingdom, a BBC transmitter, in English and beamed it to Russia. So, of course, fat lot of good that did. So Putin was able to get his message across with no contradiction. He could make up whatever facts he wanted. And that helped propel the Russia-Ukraine war. Whereas if we had had the infrastructure we did before, with the Western countries having transmissions that could get into, especially the hinterland of the Soviet Union and Russia, there might have been a different outcome. So that's failure number one. Failure number two, the new administration over here simply shut down what was left of international broadcasting, fired everybody, sent them home, shut everything down. A few weeks later, they decided they were going to take care of Iran's nuclear facilities, and they wanted to let the people know what was happening, get out of harm's way, and why they were doing it. And they realized they had no way of doing it.
Right.
So they quickly called up the staffers they had just fired, told them to come back to the office, and to whatever extent they could get through on satellite and internet, they were able to do it. But it was really a moment of something out of a Peter Sellers movie. So we've already paid the price for shutting down shortwave prematurely. Another thing that's influencing international broadcasting in shortwave is that we, not only in this country, the United States, but throughout much of the world, foreign policy soft power is pretty well faded away because you've got leaders who are very powerful and they talk to each other. So foreign policy is a dozen or two dozen people from the administrations of the countries in question, sitting down and basically having a poker game. And soft power doesn't enter into this. They're not really interested in the hearts and minds of the population. So the foreign policy establishment has been pretty much pushed in the background. And of course, international broadcasting has just been pretty much terminated.
So for the benefit of our listeners, and this is a really, really good subject area that not a lot of us sort of radio enthusiast types are interested in or know about, we can consider international broadcasting as being twofold. For the listeners, it's the average Joe chasing the signals on the radio and hoping to get some good reception and a QSL card. The reality is, as you've outlined quite clearly, is that international broadcasting is foreign policy. It's the soft power delivery of foreign policy through radio, through that dialogue, reaching listeners, influencing people around the world. And as we've discovered over time, well, now the world leaders, through various mechanisms of enhanced travel, they're all meeting with each other and doing their bidding in these closed rooms, like you describe, a poker game. So that's one element of how international broadcasting has been vanquished for the hobbyist. Is that a good approximation?
Oh, definitely. As Ian mentioned at one time earlier in his discussion, that the extent to which you have radio hobbyists now are places like Scandinavia, where they tune in medium wave AM stations from far. The concept of picking up a distant radio station being exciting, that was really big stuff going from the 1920s until maybe the 1980s, 1990s. And after that, it became old hat and there wasn't much to chase. And even things like QSL cards, I'm not sure how many stations even know what a QSL card is anymore. So that kind of approach is really a thing of the past. And if you're talking about shortwave, then I think you need to go in the spirit that Ian was talking about when he changed the name of the program from DX Digest to SWL Digest. And SWL implies that content is more important than the signal. And so we're talking international broadcasting as content, those different types of content we talked about, the official and so forth. But it's really content that's driving this. And viewed positively, we have a blank slate because international broadcasting has been decimated, shortwave has been decimated. We have pretty much a blank slate we can work from and view this as mentioned earlier, I think by Bob, turning, or no, Ian, turning lemon into lemonade. By seeing what we can do to make international broadcasting, radio or otherwise, more effective.
Well, that begs the question, upon a completion of a fresh examination of international broadcasting, is there a place for international broadcasting in the 21st century?
It's an interesting question because there's so much available on the internet, literally hundreds of thousands of stations and podcasts and things of that nature, that if you stick a government station in the middle of all that, it's lost in the herd. The nice thing about shortwave and things of that nature is that the spectrum of choices is much smaller. So you have an easier chance of grabbing someone, provided that they're actually tuning in on radio and the radio band that you're in, shortwave, whatever. But the thing that's interesting is during the Cold War, which was the high point of international broadcasting, during the Cold War, the stations set up huge fixed sites, very expensive. It's years to build, millions of dollars to put up, enormous things, taking up acres and acres or hectares. And they could do that because they were beaming to countries that were pretty well fixed in their ideologies as friends or enemies. So you could afford to do that. Now, one day, the crisis is in some country in East Asia. 2 weeks later, it's in the Middle East. 4 weeks later, it's in Central America and so forth. So what good does it do to set up these powerful shortwave stations when if they have to beam to different parts of the world, the signal is weakened because there's many more hops than the signal. So I think what needs to be done is to look at ways to make this mobile. And the fly in that ointment is that the antennas for shortwave are also huge. It's one reason they take so many acres. Can't very well put up an airplane or a spacecraft that takes up how many hectares. So technology needs to be looked at to see if we can get these antennas shrunk so you can put on airplanes and things of that sort. If they can do that, then they can put their transmissions in the parts of the world where they can get one hop, meaning you know what I'm talking about, one hop. One hop signals are the best, and get one hop signals into the target area. And the second thing they can do with these mobile things is if there's jamming, there's a thing called twilight immunity, which in many parts of the world you can use to overcome jamming in rural areas. And they can that depends on the sunset. And if you have a fixed site, of course you only have a brief period during the sunset, but if you have say an airplane, it can follow the sunset. And that twilight immunity can be stretched out instead of being an hour or so, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 hours.
Well, that's a lot to think about. And in contrast, whether or not we have a future with international broadcasting using shortwave or other mediums, the one fact remains is that we're still having conversations about the viability of these things. So it's good to get another perspective from somebody who's worked in this industry for as long as you have. Do you have any closing thoughts on where we are right now and where we're going in light of all the conflict on the planet?
Well, I think you said it right. Conflict on the planet, that's eternal. unfortunately. And there is a strong argument to be made for soft power. We have an unusual situation now, unusual people, unusual circumstances. But as the Sufi poets used to say, this too shall pass.
Yep.
And when it does, I think we'll see a resurgence of interest. And it won't be just shortwave. There'll be other media that can be used. But certainly shortwave, it seems to be old hat. But as often happens with these things, when something new comes up, people see just the good. After it's been around long enough, they see just the bad. It's been in the background now long enough that I think when people look at it afresh, they'll see an opportunity, because shortwave does things that no other medium can. It relies on a natural reflective layer from the ionosphere. And this allows us to do things, especially where jamming is concerned, that no other medium can do. So I think shortwave does have a future. And it's just that I don't think it'll be what we recall from the past.
That was Larry Magne of Passport to World Band Radio. Thank you, Larry. Now, back to Ian McFarland. Getting back to your ladder to success, I guess the top rung on that ladder was becoming a program host and producer at RCI. But with your move across the Pacific to Tokyo and Radio Japan, another rung sort of got added to that ladder.
It sure did, Colin. It was an extra rung that I certainly didn't envisage way back when I joined RCI as a producer. Now, the job at Radio Japan was very, very interesting from the standpoint that virtually everything I did at Radio Japan was something that I'd never done at RCI. Things like a news copy rewriter. And I really enjoyed that, because the news was taken off the wire service in Japanese, translated into English by a Japanese news editor, and then I get it to correct the mistakes. And I was also reading news live on the air. Of course, all of what I did at RCI was pre-recorded, because it went to all of the transmissions, and it didn't go out live to any transmission. And I also did quite a few travel features in different parts of Japan. It was very nice to be able to visit different parts of the country. And I also did live interview programs and narration on video documentaries.
I imagine there are some pitfalls when it comes to doing live interviews, at least in Japan.
Well, it sure is. There are differences, I can assure you. And in a book by the well-known American radio and TV journalist Dan Rather, which I just finished reading recently, he lists his rules for effective interviewing, one of which is, and I quote, "Listen actively." Many times, some of the best questions come from picking up on something the interview subject has said. And that's a rule I go by at any time I do interviews. Now, that quote reminds me that this particular rule doesn't always apply, especially in a country like Japan. When I was at Radio Japan, I co-hosted a weekly program where we often interviewed a Japanese person whose command of English was somewhat less than fluent, shall we say. In these cases, the interviewee would be sent the questions ahead of time so that they could write out the answers to the questions and simply read them on the air in the studio. And this one time I was following Dan Rather's rule very closely, and the follow-up question occurred to me, just as I would have done at RCI. Well, all of a sudden, the poor interviewee was madly shuffling through their pages of answers, trying to find the answer to the question I just asked. So the rules of interviewing don't always apply universally.
You know, I have to ask about Japan, Ian. A Westerner in Japan with his wife would stand out a little bit. I would imagine there are day-to-day challenges, because although you might spend 7 to 8 hours at NHK Japan, you're still living in Tokyo, and Tokyo is not an English-friendly society. So how on earth did you cope with the language gap and just getting around?
Well, we were given 3 months of Japanese lessons, and you can't learn Japanese, even basic Japanese, in 3 months. You need a year at least.
Yeah. So I'm just fascinated by the actual day-to-day that you would have in Japan, like from everything from grocery shopping to just getting around on a city that large.
Well, there isn't any English on Japanese food products, I can assure you. And there are very few English signs in Tokyo. They're not really all that tourist-friendly.
Yes.
And I can remember one day we were shopping for a couple of meals, and we looked at packages of what we thought looked like hamburger, and we bought a couple of packages. It turned out to be minced pork. One of the characters was the same, minced pork, minced beef. So if you didn't know the second symbol, you were taking potluck. But
in your time there, did you explore much outside of Tokyo?
I did a little. Actually, my wife did a lot more exploring than I did, because she was the member of a women's group at the church we were going to in Tokyo. And they had regular outings all over Tokyo and into the suburbs. And she did a lot more sightseeing in Japan than I did.
Right.
So she was able to tell me how we got there on the train or whatever. So we did a little exploring together. But an anecdote that I'm reminded of, my wife was very, very fond of sumo wrestling. She watched it religiously on television, because all of the matches were on TV. And at one time, I got a ticket to a sumo match because I was going to record a travel item on sumo wrestlers. And I was seated right behind the judges, which was only one seat removed from the actual ring. And I was there with my tape recorder getting some wild sound, and I stuck the microphone up in the air to try and get some good sound. And when I got home, my wife said, "I saw you at the sumo wrestling match." She'd seen me on television.
Right. So I'm going to switch gears here for a moment. Yeah. Between Japan, you had a very, very explicit end date for your work in Tokyo with the broadcaster, yes?
Well, the initial contract was 2 years, and it was renewable for our third year. And if they really liked you, you could stay a fourth year. But
right.
4 years was the limit. But when you're working abroad, especially if you live in Quebec, you have Quebec income tax,
yes,
federal Canadian income tax, Tokyo City income tax, Tokyo federal income tax. So there was a lot of taxes in there. Yeah. So I figured, if I don't get back to Canada, I'm going to be bankrupt from taxes.
Right.
So that's why
we
decided to go back after 2 years. But I, happily, if it hadn't been for that tax problem, I would have stayed, I think, for another year at least.
Yeah. And you've never been back?
No.
Yeah.
No. Just to give you an idea of how little they're concerned with tourists and English signs, I was told before I left Montreal that there would be a limousine bus ticket waiting for me at something called the information desk at Tokyo Narita Airport. So I went to the meet and greet counter. Couldn't make myself understood. The woman at the counter didn't understand a single word of English. So I said, well, I guess I'd better go and find myself a bus. So I took a bus. But the thing was, they had omitted to tell me where to get off the bus. But these buses, they stop at all the hotels in Tokyo. So when we got to the first hotel, And I was, I think, the only gaijin or non-Japanese person in the bus. And the gentleman got on the bus, took a look around. McFarland-san, get off here.
Just so like that.
That's how I ended up getting off the bus. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known where to get off. And I would have got lost roaming around Tokyo.
So we weren't too far into the 1990s when you decided to move west. So what was the primary incentive or reasoning from moving to the West Coast?
Well, I'd been to a couple of conferences. In the RCI had regular conferences, and one year they had it in Vancouver.
Yes.
And I got off the plane, and I looked at all those mountains, and I said, this is a beautiful place. I wonder what it would be like to live here.
Yeah.
So
you were at Expo 86.
Yes, I was. I was there twice. Actually, I was there 6 weeks before it opened, and then a few weeks after it opened.
Wow.
And it was most enjoyable. But I had also been out to another conference in Vancouver, and had another look at Vancouver. And actually, I took a couple of weeks holidays after the conference had ended, and my wife flew out from Montreal and joined me, and we tooted around Vancouver Island for a couple of weeks, and went through the town of Duncan, where I ended up moving to. But one of the main reasons that we moved to the West Coast was the West Coast doesn't have Montreal winters.
No, it doesn't.
And when you get into your 80s, Montreal winters are no fun.
Yeah, cruel.
There's a lot of ice on the sidewalks. And, of course, falls are the bane of seniors. So that was really why we moved.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't your children move out west before you did?
Actually, one of my daughters, the youngest one, had come out here. She was living in the West End and was working. My son was living in an apartment building at 6th Avenue and the Big Hill. I can't remember the name of that.
Right, Main Street, Broadway, Kingsway,
no,
Oak Street.
No, I just can't remember the name of it, but he was out here. But he found it so expensive, and yes. Vancouver is quite expensive to live in. He and his wife decided to go back to Quebec due to the expense. And my youngest daughter, who lived in the West End, she got married in 1999 and took off with her husband to Phoenix, Arizona.
Phoenix, Arizona, where she is today. You've been listening to the SWL Digest, Season 1, Episode 2, 2025. For information about these podcasts, send your email to info@dxr.ca, info@dxr.ca. Thank you for listening.